Hi, I'm Amy Goodman. If you're tuning in right now, Democracy Now! Is probably your source for news you can trust. Democracy Now! Is independent, which means we're funded by you, not the oil, gas, and coal companies when we cover climate change or the weapons manufacturers when we cover war and peace. If you and everyone who tunes into this podcast made just one $10 donation right now, we could cover our operating costs for 2019. Really, that's all it would take. Please make your tax-deductible donation today by visiting our website at democracynow.org. Have a wonderful holiday season and Happy New Year. Thank you so much. Poland, this is Democracy Now!
To waste this opportunity in Katowice would compromise our last best chance to stop runaway climate change. It would not only be immoral, it would be suicidal.
UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres issues a dire warning that nations must act now to save humanity from devastating climate change, as the United States and the world's other biggest polluters obstruct UN climate talks. How will inaction on global warming devastate developing nations, the most affected but the least to cause the crisis? We'll speak with Mina Raman of Third World Network. Then we look at the massive role the fossil fuel industry has played in this year's climate talks.
I have many things to tell Shell. I don't think I can tell them all in one day. Number one is they have to stop polluting in Niger Delta. Number two, they have to clean up their mess. Number three, they have to get
out
of the
country. We'll speak with Nigerian environmental activist Nemo Bassi. Then fossil-free Costa Rica. Their plan is to become the first decarbonized economy in the world.
I come from Costa Rica, a developing country. Nearly 100% of our electricity comes from renewable sources.
All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from Katowice, Poland. President Trump's personal attorney, Michael Cohen, has been sentenced to 3 years in prison for tax evasion, bank fraud, campaign finance violations, and lying to Congress. Cohen was sentenced after admitting he broke federal campaign finance laws by paying hush money to two women during the 2016 presidential campaign. The payments to adult film star Stormy Daniels and former Playboy model Karen McDougal were made to prevent them from speaking to the media during the presidential campaign about their alleged affairs with Trump. Federal prosecutors have said Cohen's crime was done in coordination with and at the direction of President Trump. At his sentencing, Cohen said, quote, "It was my own weakness and a blind loyalty to the man that led me to choose a path of darkness over light. I felt it was my duty to cover up his own dirty deeds," Cohen said. At a White House event on Wednesday, President Trump refused to answer questions about Michael Cohen.
Mr. President, did Michael Cohen cover up your dirty deeds? What dirty deeds is he talking about, Mr. President?
In related news, the publisher of the tabloid newspaper, The National Enquirer, has admitted it bought the rights to former Playboy model Karen McDougal's story, then suppressed it to, quote, prevent it from influencing the election. The National Enquirer is run by longtime friend of Donald Trump's, David Pecker, who's now cooperating with prosecutors. He admitted meeting with Michael Cohen and another unnamed member of Trump's campaign in August of 2015. Election law experts say the admission could put Trump and his organization in legal jeopardy. Richard Hazen, an election law professor at the University of California, Irvine, told the New York Times, quote, it's looking a lot like an illegal and unreported in-kind corporate contribution to help the campaign, exposing the Trump campaign and Trump himself to possible criminal liability, he said. In breaking news on Yemen, a ceasefire has been reached for the strategic port city of Hodeidah. This comes on the final day of peace talks in Sweden between representatives of the Houthi rebel movement and members of Yemen's Saudi-backed government. UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres has described the move as an important step. The U.S.-backed Saudi war has devastated Yemen. A new report says over half of Yemen's 28 million people are now food insecure, with 5 million people in an emergency hunger situation and 65,000 in a catastrophe hunger situation, the most severe phase. In news from Capitol Hill, California Congressmember Nancy Pelosi has secured enough votes to become the next House Speaker after striking a number of deals to win over critics, including agreeing to a four-year term limit. Pelosi held the position previously from 2003 to 2007. The Guardian newspaper is reporting the FBI kept files on a number of climate activists connected to the group 350.org. The files date from 2016, when 350.org was helping to organize the Break Free from Fossil Fuels campaign. While names have been redacted, the documents make reference to three peaceful protesters from Iowa who were arrested in Indiana while protesting at a BP refinery. The Guardian also reports the documents make an apparent reference to Bill McKibben, co-founder of 350.org. In response, McKibben said, quote, trying to deal with the greatest crisis humans have stumbled into should not require being subjected to government surveillance. But when much of our government acts as a subsidiary of the fossil fuel industry, it may be par for the course, he said. Here at the UN Climate Talks, 350.org Executive Director May Bouvy reacted to the news.
We're here in Poland for the climate talks, where a number of activists have been stopped from coming, including many of our members. And today we learned that we're being spied on in the United States. This is an attempt to intimidate the climate movement. It's not working. And the movement's growing all the time.
The New York Times has revealed the U.S. oil industry and the Koch brothers-funded American Legislative Exchange Council, or ALEC, have teamed up to wage a covert campaign to weaken the nation's car emission standards. A key player in the push to roll back the Obama administration's fuel efficiency standards has been Marathon Petroleum, the country's largest refinery. Meanwhile, the Times reports the oil industry lobby also ran a covert campaign on Facebook to urge people to support rolling back the fuel efficiency standards. In August, the Environmental Protection Agency announced it'll freeze Obama-era fuel economy standards at 2020 levels in the latest blow by the Trump administration against efforts to curb catastrophic climate change. In Britain, Prime Minister Theresa May has survived a no-confidence vote, ensuring she'll stay in power as contentious Brexit negotiations move forward.
So here is our renewed mission, delivering the Brexit that people voted for, bringing the country back together, and building a country that truly works for everyone.
Earlier this week, May halted a parliamentary vote on a Brexit deal after members of her Conservative Party said they would oppose it. She's scheduled to meet with European leaders in Brussels today, though European Union officials have said they will not reopen negotiations on Brexit. China's detained two Canadians in apparent retaliation for the recent arrest of a top Chinese executive in Vancouver, Canada. The men have been identified as Michael Kovrig, a former Canadian diplomat who now works for the International Crisis Group, and Michael Spavor, who runs cultural exchanges with North Korea. They're both accused of suspicion of endangering national security. Meanwhile, a Canadian court has granted bail to Meng Wanzhou, chief financial officer of the Chinese tech giant Huawei, who faces possible extradition to the United States for allegedly violating U.S. sanctions on Iran. Tension is rising between the United States and Turkey after Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan threatened to launch an offensive against U.S.-backed Kurdish fighters in Syria who've been battling ISIS. Erdogan said he wants to clear Kurdish fighters from east of the Euphrates. The U.S. military said such an action is unacceptable. a high-ranking Vatican official, has been convicted of sexually molesting two boys in Australia. Most recently, Cardinal George Pell was the Vatican's chief financial officer. Some considered him the third most powerful official in the Vatican. He previously served as Archbishop of Sydney and Melbourne, Australia. The shocking news, however, is not being reported in Australia due to a court gag order. Today's edition of the Herald Sun features a large black box with the word censored in white capital letters. Earlier this week, Pope Francis removed Pell and Chilean Cardinal Francisco Javier Errázuriz from his inner circle. Errázuriz has been accused by survivors of covering up and discrediting their stories of abuse in Chile. It's been a deadly 24 hours in the West Bank. Two Israelis died today when a Palestinian gunman opened fire at a bus stop. This came just hours after Israeli troops carried out several deadly raids, killing three Palestinians in the West Bank. Meanwhile, in Gaza, hundreds of Palestinians attended a funeral Wednesday for a four-year-old boy who died after being hit by Israeli shrapnel. Ahmed Abu Abed was injured while attending the Great March of Return protest, along with his father, Yasser, who was shot during the demonstration.
We were 300 meters away. They were shooting and two were injured before I was. Then an explosion happened in front of us. After that, I got injured. Then my son did. And the people removed him from the area and then removed me.
More than 195 Palestinians have been killed by Israeli forces since the Great March of Return rallies began on March 30th. Temple University has said it will not take action against media studies professor Mark Lamont Hill, who was recently fired from CNN after he gave a speech in support of Palestinian rights at the United Nations. In his speech, Lamont Hill uses the phrase "Free Palestine from the river to the sea," which conservatives and pro-Israel groups say is used by Hamas and other anti-Israeli government groups. Temple University said Lamont Hill's speech was protected by the First Amendment. New data from the Centers for Disease Control shows the rate of gun deaths in the United States has reached a 20-year high. According to the CDC, almost 40,000 people were killed in shootings in 2017. That's an average of over 100 shooting deaths a day. 60% of the shooting deaths were suicides. In New York, Brooklyn's district attorney has dropped charges against 23-year-old Jasmine Headley, who was arrested last week and had her 18-month-old son ripped from her arms as she waited at a Brooklyn benefits office for a child care voucher. Video of the incident shows Headley clutching her son to her chest and screaming as she's pinned to the floor by NYPD officers who are wrenching the child out of her arms. When bystanders protested Headley's treatment, an officer waved a taser at them. Headley says when she got to the Human Resources Administration office to apply for a child care benefit, there were no chairs available, so she and her son sat on the floor where they waited for over 4 hours. When a pair of security officers demanded she stand, Headley refused and the guards called in the police. Headley was arrested Friday on several charges, including resisting arrest and child endangerment. The charges were dropped Tuesday after Headley spent the weekend in jail, separated from her son. In media news, staffers at the recently unionized digital news outlet Slate have voted to go on strike. The action is a response to Slate's inclusion of a so-called right-to-work clause in ongoing contract negotiations. The policy would weaken the union by making membership fees optional. In New York, employees at a new Amazon fulfillment center in Staten Island have announced plans to unionize. Employees cited as some of their concerns safety, low pay, high performance quotas, and long shifts with few breaks. Last month, Amazon announced its new expanded headquarters would be located in Arlington, Virginia, and Queens, New York City. sparking local protests and opposition from a number of community groups and some local leaders. And Dr. Christine Blasey Ford has made her first public appearance since her Senate testimony in September, when she accused then-Supreme Court nominee Brett Kavanaugh of sexual assault. Blasey Ford recorded a video message presenting the Sports Illustrated Inspiration of the Year Award to Rachel Denhollander, who is the first woman to publicly accuse former USA gymnastics doctor Larry Nassar of sexual abuse. Nassar was accused of molesting 265 girls and women over decades and has received what amounts to multiple life sentences. This is part of Dr. Christine Blasey Ford's message.
Rachel Denhollander, I am in awe of you, and I will always be inspired by you. In stepping forward, you took a huge risk, and you galvanized future generations to come forward, even when the odds are seemingly stacked against them. The lasting lesson is that we all have the power to create real change, and we cannot allow ourselves to be defined by the acts of others.
And those are some of the headlines. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Katowice, Poland, where UN Secretary General Antonio Guterres issued a dire warning Wednesday that nations must act now to save humanity from devastating climate change.
To waste this opportunity in Katowice would compromise our last best chance to stop runaway climate change. It would not only be immoral, it would be suicidal. Failing here in Katowice would send a disastrous message to those who stand ready to shift to a green economy. So I urge you to find common ground that will allow us to show the world that we are listening, that we care. Developed countries must scale up their contributions to jointly mobilize $100 billion annually by 2020.
Despite this call to action, talks here in Katowice have been hindered by the United States and the world's other biggest polluters, who are promoting fossil fuels and focusing on reducing emissions in developing countries, but not their own. Talks are supposed to conclude on Friday, but negotiators have expressed little hope in meeting that deadline. Meanwhile, climate experts warn inaction on global warming will devastate developing nations that are the most affected by climate change, but have done the least to cause it. Well, for more, we're joined by Mina Raman. She's coordinator of the Climate Change Program at Third World Network and is honorary secretary of Friends of Earth Malaysia. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Mina. It's great to have you with us. Can you talk about the progress in the talks, in these summits, and who you feel is getting in the way of where you want these talks to be?
Well, I think we are acting far too slowly. Those of us who were in Paris wanted movement much faster. And we are here negotiating guidelines to implement the Paris Agreement. And here what we see, unfortunately, is the United States, which has announced that it has no intention to be a party to the Paris Agreement, negotiating the rules for implementation. So it's really hypocritical that the United States is here negotiating in what I would characterize as bad faith. And the reason why I say this is that the deal was already done. The political deal was done in 2015. Here, the governments are supposed to help each other implement the agreement that was achieved. Now, what you see the United States do is to renegotiate the Paris Agreement. It's seeking to dilute further what was a very delicate treaty that was concluded.
Can you explain what the U.S. is doing here? Trump has said that the U.S. is pulling out. He's pulling the U.S. out of the agreement, although it takes a few years to do that.
Yeah.
And yet they clearly are behind the scenes here in force, beginning with, and this wasn't behind the scenes, working with Saudi Arabia, their close ally, despite what it's done in Yemen, despite its dismemberment of a Washington Post columnist, Jamal Khashoggi, working hand in hand with Saudi Arabia to undercut the UN's Nobel Peace Prize winning scientific body, the IPCC, in their new report on the devastating effects of climate change?
Well, the U.S. has very clearly said in Songdo, when the IPCC report was adopted, that it doesn't agree with the scientific findings. And yet it is here, and it has already announced that it's going to pull out. And yet it's negotiating. So the confusion for us is, what is the U.S. up to? And what it's trying to do here is that to deny those countries who are asking for climate finance, where under the Paris Agreement, it was already agreed that climate finance will be provided. So they come here and they say, we are not willing to commit to any new discussion on finance if the donor base is not widened. So this is renegotiating. I think what they mean is that if China doesn't come on board, the U.S. is not willing to put any money on the table. But it's not even clear whether the U.S. will do anything at all because it is a climate denier. So what we worry is for those nations who have already put their climate actions on the table as to what they would do when the Paris Agreement kicks off in 2020, post-2020, and they very clearly indicated that we can do more, but we will need technology transfer, we would need finance. But these are non-negotiable as far as the U.S. is concerned. So there's no money on the table, no indication of any discussion for new money. There is no commitment to discuss real technology transfer.
What do you mean by technology transfer?
Well, it means that this is a global problem. Developing countries would need to transition from dependence on fossil fuels to a low-carbon future. Now, in order to do that, they will have to shift dramatically and not repeat the mistakes of the developed world. So in order to do that, we need renewable energies of massive scales. We need all the technologies that are environmentally sound, that are able to allow the developing countries to move from fossil fuel dependence to non-fossil fuel dependence.
Mina, can you talk about what survival emissions are?
Yeah, for the poor of the world who had no contribution to emissions, for instance, large amounts of people in India are denied any access to energy. Now, they are being told that they have to reduce their carbon emissions. Now, these are people who emit nothing. They have to survive. They have to eat. They have to go to school. They have to have health care. But all these is not possible because they don't have access to energy. Now, we are saying that these people who have very little contribution to any emissions, they are being asked to contribute to reducing emissions. I mean, it's hypocritical because the United States does not want to acknowledge that it is the largest historical emitter in the world. Now, you don't have enough carbon space to allow countries like the United States to continue to emit. You need the survival emissions for people who actually are able to transition and develop. And this is what the big fight is about.
What's a comparison of what a U.S. Citizen expends in using emissions versus people in India, for example, or in the developing world?
Well, you know, all the cars and the gasoline.
How much bigger is the carbon footprint?
Well, I don't know the latest numbers, but I know for a fact that the U.S. per capita emissions is something like 24 tons or so. And you have countries like India who are less than one. So you see the scale is massively different. And so you do need to, the poor, this is like
And you're not talking about the whole population of India. You're talking about the poor.
No, I'm talking about
India
the poor,
but
the large numbers of poor in India who actually have very little to live on. And so, you see, if you want to limit temperature rise, there is a finite carbon space that is left. So for countries like the United States, who have grown wealthy due to their emissions, without any constraint on their carbon, they have become wealthy. And for the poor, who remain poor, and for them you say, no, you cannot emit and you can't have any alternative. You are condemning these people to poverty, condemning them even to death, actually. So this is why what we say is the climate problem has to be addressed in a differentiated manner. Those with greater historical responsibility must act.
What role is China playing?
China has played a very
constructive role. It's the largest polluter now. Is that right?
Yes, it is.
As opposed to the U.S. being the largest historically.
Correct. But if you take per capita emissions, China is still much, much, much lesser than the United States. So this is why you do need to acknowledge that you cannot treat all people in the same way, because this is where the common but differentiated responsibility from Rio. You remember when George Bush, when in 1992 he said that the lifestyles of the Americans are not up for negotiations.
George H.W. Bush, who just died.
What you have to remember is there is finite resources. The rich cannot continue to take and take. And so if you remember what Gandhi said, if we all follow the American lifestyle, we will need another six planets. And so this is not how the future of the world should be. So the poor have to be able to survive. They have to be enabled to move to a transition in a way that doesn't replicate the lifestyle of the Americans.
Meena Raman, you've said that approaches such as carbon markets are rooted in colonialism and environmental racism. What do you mean by that?
The carbon markets, as far as we are concerned, are mechanisms to actually not do the real domestic reductions that are needed.
What are carbon markets?
Well, these are just markets which trade in carbon, where they believe that, like for instance in Malaysia, we are a massive forest country. And so there are companies that go around our part of the world and saying that the more that you protect the forest, those credits that allow the saving of the carbon dioxide, we will quantify them and then we will trade them in the international market so that you will get money for them. And the offsets, the reductions that we do, will count to the domestic reductions of the developed countries. So what they're actually telling us is we will pay you cheaply to do the emissions reductions for us, and the developed world doesn't have to do the domestic reductions that they have to do. So this is actually not the solution. The solution is everyone has to decarbonize.
Finally, what needs to come out of these talks?
Well, we must have rules that are fair and just. For instance, the Paris Agreement cannot just be about reporting. The United States just wants everyone to report better in terms of what actions they are doing. But what we actually need to do is to see finance on the table, real commitment to deliver on finance. For instance, the Green Climate Fund is in need of massive replenishment. The United States pledged $3 billion initially under the Obama administration. Only $1 billion is there. The $2 billion that was committed under the Obama administration is no longer there. So developing countries are looking at the Green Climate Fund to deliver on the kind of actions that they need to do. So if the Green Climate Fund is a vehicle for undertaking the transformation in developing countries, then massive replenishment of resources has to happen now, has to happen today. The other thing that has to happen is basically the technology that needs to be transferred. Here, what the United States says is that technology is in the hands of the private sector, so it's a commercial venture. This is not about a commercial venture. This is a global problem, and so we need affordable, accessible technologies so that developing countries don't have to go in the same pathway as the developed world. So the United States is halting progress on all this, and it's a climate denier, and it's preventing those who want to do action from taking action.
Meena Raman, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Meena Raman is the coordinator of the Climate Change Program at Third World Network, and she's the honorary secretary of Friends of the Earth Malaysia. This is Democracy Now! When we come back, we'll be joined by Nimo Bassi, leading environmental activist from Nigeria. Stay with us. Madrix by Big Band Katowice. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit here in Katowice, Poland. We now turn to take a closer look at the major role fossil fuel companies are playing in negotiations just a day before the climate talks are expected to end. Officials from nearly 200 countries are here to negotiate how to implement the 2015 Paris Agreement. But so are representatives from many of the world's largest fossil fuel companies, including a lobby group that represents BP, Shell and ExxonMobil, who are here to push their own agendas behind the scenes. Just last week, The Intercept reported an executive from Shell Oil told participants at a COP side event, that's COP, Conference of Parties, that Shell helped draft a portion of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement dealing with emissions mitigation. He made the remarks at an event for corporate actors, including the fossil fuel industry, saying, quote, "The European Union's position is not that different from how Shell sees this." This week, activists protested outside an event hosted by Shell. Among those demonstrating was Rita Uwaka and Nemo Bassi.
In the Niger Delta, where I come from, we have endured 60 years of oil pollution, of gross pollution, gas flares, and human rights abuses. Today, the world has 12 short years to do the right thing about climate change. Oil companies and their cohorts must be held to account. Today, what do we say?
It's like hell on earth. I represent communities in the Niger Delta who are impacted by this big polluter. Having this big polluter come here as a saint is not only a slap on us as delegates of COP, is also a slap on Mother Earth.
That is really why we are here, because of the open boast, the open insult from the Shell official telling the whole world that they wrote Article 6 of the Paris Agreement and that they are here introducing language into the rule book. Shell will be telling us that they are the one determining how the action to be taken will be taken, which means nothing is going to happen and nobody's going to do anything positive from this COP. This is why we've always suspected that the so-called nationally determined contributions are nothing but nationally determined confusions. I have many things to tell Shell. I don't think I can tell them all in one day. Number one is they have to stop polluting the Niger Delta. Number two, they have to clean up their mess. Number three, they have to get out of the COP.
That's Nemo Bassi, who joins us now from the UN climate talks here in Katowice, Poland. He's a Nigerian environmental activist and the director of the Health of Mother Earth Foundation. He's the author of a number of books, including Oil Politics, Echoes of Ecological Wars, and To Cook a Continent, Destructive Extraction and Climate Crisis in Africa. Welcome back to Democracy Now! It's great to have you every year here at the COP, wherever it is. And again, COP stands for Conference of Parties to the Climate Talks, and this year it's COP24 for the 24th year. Nemo, we just heard your protest. Can you talk about the role of corporations in these climate talks?
Thank you very much, Amy, for having me on the program. It's really very troubling to see that a conference that is dealing with existential matters, that deals with the future of the planet, of humanity, of all the beings on the planet, can just be manipulated by fossil fuel industry. It almost seems like the Conference of Parties, the COP, is now the Conference of Polluters. Conference of Polluters, yes. And this is why we're not making much progress. You just look at the Paris Agreement. This was so much celebrated around the world. Countries quickly endorsed it, except one politician that quickly turned away from it.
You're talking about President
tweeting,
Trump.
Tweeting about it. I guess what he's tweeting about, this particular COP now. This was so popular with politicians because the result was such a manipulated outcome that everyone could see that they were not really going to do anything that science requires. And the Paris Agreement was based on what nations choose to do. And this is just the design and the desire of the fossil fuel industry, because They fought hard in the backgrounds of the lobby halls to ensure that fossil fuel, those two words are not mentioned in the Paris Agreement. Fossil fuels are not mentioned at all. And we all know that this is why we have global warming. The burning of fossil fuels. This is what is pumping carbon into the atmosphere. Mm-hmm. And if we have a conference, a convention, whose job is to set the world on a path that would save us from catastrophic global warming, that should be the first thing to be dealt with. But we're not seeing that at all.
Talk about what's happening in Nigeria, Africa's most populous country and the largest oil-producing African country.
Yeah, oil has been a nightmare to Nigeria. Oil was found in commercial quantities in 1956. The first commercial extraction and export was in 1958. So oil has been an income earner for Nigeria for 60 solid years, six decades of oil. It became a major income earner in the 1970s, and this helped to twist the political situation in the country and made politicians more or less struggle to be in charge of the oil revenue. And so right now, oil has damaged our politics, damaged our economy, and damaged our environment. If you step to the Niger Delta as we speak, there's always an ongoing oil spill. If you step to the Niger Delta as we speak, you can find rivers and creeks coated with crude oil. And you just think about this kind of destructive resource that is pumping carbon into the atmosphere. People live next to oil fields. They don't have access to energy. They're having gas furnaces lighting up the sky. Kids can't enjoy a dark night sky. They can't enjoy a quiet night, a quiet moment, because these furnaces are burning continuously. And yet, this same thing is creating the climate crisis. We are losing land to the sea through sea level rise. We are losing the major water body in northeastern Nigeria, where you have also violent conflicts between farmers and herders. And, you know, it's such a destructive thing. Lake Chad, I was trying to mention. Lake Chad was 25,000 square kilometers in the 1960s. Now it's down to about 2,500 square kilometers. Lost 90% of its size. This is catastrophic for the region.
I wanted to go back to the power of the corporation. Speaking last week at an International Emissions Trading Association side event here at the COP was Shell's chief climate change advisor, David Hone, who boasted the oil company had a hand in writing the Paris Agreement. Hone stated, "We have had a process running for 4 years for the need of carbon and trading to be part of the Paris Agreement. We can take some credit for the fact that Article 6 of the Paris Agreement is even there at all. We put together a straw proposal. Many of the elements of that straw proposal appear in the Paris Agreement. We put together another straw proposal for the rule book, and we saw some of that appear in the text." Well, it sounds like the Paris Agreement exceeded his wildest expectations.
They are gamblers, and they won the bet. And I mean, they have every reason to celebrate, because the world keeps, if you listen to politicians and, of course, listen to the industry, they keep saying they know that as the Intergovernmental Panel on Global Warming told us that we have 12 years to do something about emissions reduction, but the oil corporations keep selling the narrative that the world cannot generate energy except from fossil fuels into the foreseeable future. So even the negotiators buy this crap, this falsehood, this lie, because we're much more creative than that. But the industry is locking in everyone on this fossil pathway. And then they're trading the carbon. So you keep on polluting, keep on business as usual, keep on using dirty energy. Industries can release as much carbon as they like into the atmosphere. There's always a way to offset. And this offsetting is putting the burden of real climate action on poor nations, on poor communities, in the kind of fiction that the pollution by industrialized nations is offset by trees in poor communities. This is a fiction of carbon markets.
Can you talk about the significance of this COP24 being held here in Poland? It is the only country, I believe, where the UN Climate Summit has taken place three times. First was Poznan, then we were in Warsaw, and now we're here in Katowice. This is, you know, coal land is Poland, and this is the coal heart of Poland. How does that affect these talks with the coal companies virtually co-sponsoring, partnering with these talks? We're in a convention center that's on an old coal mine site. There's a coal museum next door. And this design of the convention center is to make it look like a coal mine.
We're in the belly of the mine, actually. So literally, that's where we are. And it's very significant that the Polish government chose to host this conference right in a coal pit, so to speak. The dark coal pit with staircases, you keep climbing. I saw you running after a politician the other yesterday up the stairs. And, you know, this is really... it's a bold step by the Polish state to tell the world that, look, we are on the fossil path. This is where we're going to go. We are not really shifting. But the challenge for them is that I don't think they would want to have a COP that failed in Poland. But the way we're going, I don't think there's a solution anywhere near. So this is the challenge we're going to face. They could be proud of coal. The industry is pushing in the background. The oil and gas companies are pushing along with them. But, you know, when something is wrong, it is wrong.
So as we wrap up, what gives you hope, Nimmo Bassi?
My hope is in the people. Because while the politicians and the negotiators are having difficulties coming to agreement, people out in the street, people in at the climate hub, social society, civil society, and people in communities all agree that this thing must be taken on heads on. And we all, in fact, right from 2010 in Cochabamba, Bolivia, there was a very clear roadmap of what needs to be done. This is 70 years of Universal Declaration of Human Rights. It's time, I have the hope, that the world will wake up to respect the rights of Mother Earth, the rights of nature. The people give me hope. And the planet is resilient, but we can't just take it for granted.
Well, Nimmo Bassi is Nigerian environmental activist, director of the Health of Mother Earth Foundation, author of a number of books, including Oil Politics, Echoes of Ecological Wars, and To Cook a Continent, Destructive Extraction and Climate Crisis in Africa. When we come back, fossil-free Costa Rica, we'll speak with activist Monica Araya about Costa Rica's plan to become the first decarbonized economy in the world. Stay with us. Thanks, Nimmo. Hell here on Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We're broadcasting from the UN Climate Summit in Katowice, Poland. We end today's show looking at a small country with taking a huge stand against climate change despite inaction of the world leaders. Costa Rica has a plan to go fossil-free beginning next year, becoming the first decarbonized economy in the world. Costa Rica already generates more than 90% of its electricity using renewable energy. In 2017, it went 300 days on clean energy alone. Costa Rica is here at the UN climate talks in Katowice, and the Costa Rican officials have announced they want to host UN climate talks in 2019, since Brazil rescinded its offer to host the annual summit following the election of the right-wing former Army Captain Jair Bolsonaro, also a climate change denier like the President of the United States, President Trump. Announcing the plan, Costa Rica's Minister of Environment and Energy, Carlos Manuel Rodriguez, said, quote, "The benefits of hosting this event are many for the country, such as the possibility of positioning our decarbonization plan and our route towards this goal. We could also push more ambitious projects in the area of climate change and decarbonization of the world economies." Well, for more, we're joined by Monica Araya, a Costa Rican climate activist who works with the president of Costa Rica on sustainability issues. She's the director of Costa Rica Limpia, an NGO promoting carbon neutrality and clean energy. Araya's recent piece for Project Syndicate is headlined, "The Latest Climate Science Must Mobilize Us, Not Paralyze Us." Monica, welcome to Democracy Now! It's great to have you with us. Fossil-free Costa Rica, explain what it means to go 300 days doing what?
Fossil-free Costa Rica is already happening because what we say to other Costa Ricans is that while the world is debating how to become more renewable, you know, 30% by 2030, we are already there. So the first point is that for us, this is something that is happening when we dry our hair, when we make coffee. That electricity is already fossil free. So one thing we keep emphasizing in our national debates is that decarbonization as such is not a new idea for us because it's already there. The other thing is that
tell me, how did you do 300 days of what? What does this exactly mean?
What it means is that when you turn on the light, that electricity comes either from water, wind, or our volcanoes, increasingly solar. So one of the things that we noticed is that it was normal for us to be renewable, and it was in the context of the climate discussions that we realized we were quite special. So there is one point. The other point is that in places like Brazil or Indonesia, the problem with decarbonization is about deforestation. And we reversed deforestation in the 90s, which means that the other big headache that the world has, we already solved. So the next headache is the one we're trying to solve now, and I can tell you more, because the next frontier for us is for a citizen in my country to wake up in the morning, turn on the light, know that it's renewable, but then realize that the car or the bus this person will take is also using electricity instead of oil. So at the end of the day, being fossil free for us means breaking free from fossil fuels. Mm-hmm. And if that sounds a bit idealistic, I want to tell you what happened a few days ago. The president of our country, who is 38, the youngest president in our continent, he got into a car with the CEO of the public utility, a woman. The woman who runs this electricity company is driving a car with the president and the wife, and they are singing and they are celebrating the fact that that car is going from A to B without using any fossil fuels. So my point is that in terms of hearts and minds, what is going on right now is that we are celebrating this as something that is not about the climate necessarily, because at the end of the day, our emissions are not the problem, but it's more about the next big idea for a small country that is going to turn 200 years old. Mm. So we're mixing the narrative of fossil free with the story of a country that by the time it turns 200 years old wants to become a lab for the world so that other countries can learn from us.
So you want to host next year's COP, the COP25.
Yes.
Because the far right candidate mm-hmm. in Brazil mm-hmm. has just won the presidency.
Yes.
And one of his first acts is saying he's going to, that they've disinvited the COP from mm-hmm. Brazil. Mm-hmm. We heard that it might be in New York next year. Is that true?
What will happen in New York next year is going to be a very busy city for climate negotiations, or at least climate discussions. is that there will be a big summit that the Secretary General is going to host to kind of... politics, you know, polarizing, denying climate change, working against women. So New York will be an important moment around September, and then the idea is to end in December with an uplifting COP, contrary to this one here, where, you know, we know you just cannot get very inspired when you know there is so much coal when you get out and your breathing is affecting when you is affected when you realize that the president is defending coal. So this process needs to be energized by a country that can shake things
up. Have windmills been outlawed here in Poland?
I don't think, well, I don't know enough about Poland, so I should not comment on that. But I do know that the president did defend fossil fuels, which to us is almost like going to a podium and saying you are against the female vote, you know? It's the equivalent of that.
Speaking of women, what role, the importance of women when it comes to a decarbonized economy, a sustainable way of living? I mean, in Costa Rica, one of the leading officials is Cristiana Figueres, who is the Costa Rican diplomat who was executive secretary of the UN Framework Convention on Climate Change. Talk about the significance of this, but women overall.
So clearly, when you have somebody like Cristiana being so prominent, that is already very inspiring. And that has been obviously very visible for the new generation. But I can also give you examples of things that are happening right now. We are the first country in Latin America to have a law that incentivizes zero emissions electric mobility, buses, trains, cars, e-bikes. The woman or the person who we work with in Congress is a woman who had to push for an idea that at the time, 2 years ago, was a little too far out, and we worked together, Marcela Guerrero and us. And I can tell you that when you get into transportation conversations, when you have to deal with car dealerships and with the car ecosystem, having a congresswoman and an activist promoting this idea that we had to go fossil-free in the transportation sector was unusual because the car industry is pretty male-dominated.
You think electric cars and conventional cars may cost the same by 2022?
By 2025. But the law that we passed is doing that for now. For 5 years before this happens, we are giving incentives so that we get price parity before this happens. But the price parity will happen because as you scale up the technology, the batteries will come down.
Costa Rica is exceptional in many ways. Among them, the country abolished the army in the 1940s.
Yes. I was going to say that. If you were a child in my country, that's the story, right? And I do think storytelling is very important. So you grow up listening to the story of a country that did not have the army. And that's why now that we're going to become 200 years old, that abolition that framed our national stories is very important for the next abolition, which is the abolition of fossil fuels. In fact, the president said that in May when he was inaugurated. The other thing is that we already have a moratorium on oil drilling. And because of this leadership, actually, is another woman in Congress, very young woman called Paula Vega. She is proposing two laws to complement the decarbonization plan that we have drafted. So, by the way, the decarbonization plan is going to be out the 24th of February. If you want to hear about it, because it's linked to that idea that you mentioned of the abolition of the army.
Before we go, because we're going to end with, you talked about young people, a 15-year-old girl who gave a speech at the plenary last night. But before we go
Greta
Thunberg, yes. I wanted to ask you about Costa Rica's new vice president, Epsi Campbell Barr, first woman of African descent to be elected vice president, not just in Costa Rica, but anywhere in North or South America.
Yes, very proud of that. And she is super important in this story because at the end of the day, we cannot talk about going fossil free in the abstract. This is not about just an emission story. It's about building a much better society. And this is an example of a more diverse society that we want to build.
The conversation continues maybe next year, COP25 in Costa Rica.
Yes.
I want to thank you very much, Monica Araya, who is a Costa Rican climate activist. And we are going to end today with the words of 15-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg, who addressed the UN plenary session last night.
My name is Greta Thunberg. I am 15 years old and I'm from Sweden. I speak on behalf of Climate Justice Now. Many people say that Sweden is just a small country and it doesn't matter what we do. But I've learned that you are never too small to make a difference. And if a few children can get headlines all over the world just by not going to school, then imagine what we could all do together if we really wanted to. But to do that, we have to speak clearly, no matter how uncomfortable that may be. You only speak of green, eternal economic growth because you are too scared of being unpopular. You only talk about moving forward with the same bad ideas that got us into this mess, even when the only sensible thing to do is pull the emergency brake. You are not mature enough to tell it like it is. Even that burden you leave to us children. But I don't care about being popular. I care about climate justice and a living planet. Our civilization is being sacrificed for the opportunity of a very small number of people to continue making enormous amounts of money. Our biosphere is being sacrificed so that rich people in countries like mine can live in luxury. It is the sufferings of the many which pay for the luxuries of the few. The year 2078, I will celebrate my 75th birthday. If I have children, maybe they will spend that day with me. Maybe they will ask me about you. Maybe they will ask why you didn't do anything while there still was time to act. You say you love your children above all else, and yet you are stealing their future in front of their very eyes. Until you start focusing on what needs to be done rather than what is politically possible, there is no hope. We cannot solve a crisis without treating it as a crisis. We need to keep the fossil fuels in the ground, and we need to focus on equity. And if solutions within this system are so impossible to find, then maybe we should change the system itself. We have not come here to beg world leaders to care. You have ignored us in the past, and you will ignore us again. You have run out of excuses, and we are running out of time. We have come here to let you know that change is coming, whether you like it or not. The real power belongs to the people. Thank you.
You've just been listening to 15-year-old Swedish climate activist Greta Thunberg addressing the UN plenary last night. She has called for a global school strike on Friday. That does it for our show. A very special thanks to Democracy Now!'s Mike Burke and John Hamilton and Sam Alkoff and Libby Rainey. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks.